picture Trepassey Bay, Newfoundland. May 14, 1919. Three enormous flying boats sitting low in the cold green water of the harbor, their gray hulls barely visible in a sky that has been nothing but fog and drizzle for 5 days straight. The mechanics are still at it on the work floats around each aircraft, checking fuel lines, testing magnetos, arguing quietly about torque values and engine mounts. Inside the crew quarters ashore, navigators are bent over their charts with parallel rules and pencils, cross-referencing lists of destroyer positions. 68 American destroyers have been stationed across the North Atlantic to mark the route east, one ship roughly every 50 miles from Newfoundland to the Azores, each crew ready to burn flares, fire star shells, and sweep searchlights across the night sky to help the aircraft find their way. It is the most elaborate support network ever assembled for an aviation mission. And the crews sitting in Trepassey Bay know somewhere in the back of their minds that all of it still might not be enough. They are about to attempt the first transatlantic crossing in the history of flight. Most people don't know that. Most people, if you stop them and ask, will tell you Charles Lindbergh was first across the Atlantic. He was not. These Navy crews were 8 years ahead of him, and almost none of their names are household words today. I'm Tail Dragger. This is The Hangar on Radio Hangar. Pull up a chair. Today's broadcast is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, Aviation Challenge Coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot certificate, instrument rating, all the way up to ATP. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now, back to 1919. The aircraft sitting in Trepassey Bay were called the NC boats. NC stood for Navy Curtis, a working partnership between the United States Navy and Glenn Curtis, whose company was producing some of the finest flying boats in the world at that moment. Curtis was already a legend. He had built the first aircraft to take off from and land on a naval vessel. He had set speed records. His flying boats had been workhorses of naval patrol work during the war. When the Navy needed someone to design an aircraft capable of crossing the Atlantic, the conversation started and ended with Curtis. The design brief was demanding. The aircraft needed to carry enough gasoline to cover 1,200 miles of open ocean on a single leg. It needed to handle open water landings and Atlantic swells without coming apart. It needed to keep its engines running for 15 hours or more at sustained power. The Liberty engine was the standard for large American military aircraft by then, a 12-cylinder water-cooled power plant producing 400 horsepower per unit. The NC boats would carry four of them. Curtis's engineer settled on a biplane hull design, deep and boat-shaped to handle rough water, with the four Liberty engines mounted above the center wing section in an unusual tandem push-pull arrangement. Two engines faced forward, pulling, two faced aft, pushing, the propellers counter-rotated, and the clearances between them had to be precise. Get it wrong, and the blades would destroy each other inside of a second. It was complicated, it was heavy, it worked. The wingspan came out to 126 feet, roughly the length of a Boeing 737. Fully loaded with fuel and crew and equipment, the aircraft weighed nearly 28,000 pounds. The fuel tanks held over 1,700 gallons of gasoline. Running all four Liberty engines at sustained power produced a sound you felt in your chest from 100 yards away. A deep, rhythmic thunder that had no precedent in American aviation at the time. Four NC boats were built. One was destroyed in a hangar fire before the transatlantic mission could begin. Three remained, NC-1, NC-3, and NC-4. The decision to attempt the crossing in May of 1919 wasn't purely driven by exploration. There was competition in the air, literally. The London Daily Mail newspaper had posted a prize of £10,000 for the first crew to cross the Atlantic nonstop by air. The prize had been waiting since 1913, interrupted by the war, and now that the war was over, teams from both sides of the Atlantic were making their moves. The Navy wasn't officially competing. The prize required a non-stop crossing, and the Navy's plan called for fuel stops in the Azores and Lisbon, staged, methodical, professional, but they wanted to be first across the Atlantic by air. Full stop. And other teams were already in motion. Harry Hawker, an Australian test pilot, and his navigator Kenneth Mackenzie Grieve had departed Newfoundland the previous month in a Sopwith Atlantic biplane, attempting the non-stop crossing. They made it roughly 1,400 miles before engine cooling problems forced them down into the ocean. A Danish cargo ship happened to be nearby and pulled them out of the water. The ship had no wireless radio, so no message reached Britain for over a week. Hawker and Grieve were presumed dead. The newspapers had already written their obituaries when the Danish ship finally made port in Scotland with both men alive. The field was temporarily clear. The NC boats were in position. It was just a matter of whether Trepassey Bay in May is not anyone's idea of a comfortable place to wait. The fog rolled in every evening off the North Atlantic. The wind had a particular kind of cold that gets into your joints and stays there. The crews lived on Navy food and weather briefings, and very little sleep for 5 days. There is a specific kind of tension that builds when you're ready, and the weather is not, and the men in Trepassi knew it well by the time the window finally opened. NC-4 was commanded by Lieutenant Commander Albert Cushing Reed, who served as navigator and overall commander of the boat. Reed had a reputation in the Navy as methodical, precise, and almost unsettlingly calm. He was the officer who planned everything twice, who never raised his voice, who could look at a deteriorating situation and respond in exactly the same flat tone he used to order breakfast. His pilots were Lieutenant Elmer Stone, a Coast Guard officer with more open water flying boat hours than almost anyone in the service, and Lieutenant Walter Hinton. His engineering officer was Lieutenant James Brees, who by that point had been living with the Liberty engines long enough that he claimed he could hear a misfire before the instruments caught it. Ensign Herbert Rodd handled the radio. Chief Machinist's Mate Eugene Rhodes knew the mechanical systems with a familiarity that sometimes alarmed the officers who were nominally responsible for them. 6 men, 1 flying boat, 1,200 miles of North Atlantic. On the evening of May 16th, the weather window arrived. All 3 NC boats started their engines. The leg from Trepassi to the Azores was the longest single overwater flight in the history of aviation to that point. Most of it would be at night. The destroyers were stationed along the route, but fog and overcast conditions meant the crews couldn't always find them. The plan was to navigate by dead reckoning and compass, take star shots when the sky cooperated, and use the destroyer lights as position checkpoints when they appeared in the murk below. NC-1 ran into heavy fog east of Newfoundland, and the crew lost their position. After hours of confusion and false bearings, the commander decided to descend and land on the ocean surface to reorient. The Atlantic in May is not gentle about that kind of decision. NC-1 hit a heavy swell on landing and took serious structural damage. The crew managed to get a distress signal out and were eventually located by a passing Greek steamship. The flying boat was taken under tow, but sank before it reached port. All hands survived. NC-3 fared worse in one sense and something like heroic in another. Commander John Towers, the senior officer of the entire operation, also encountered fog and lost his position. NC-3 descended and landed on swells too heavy for a flying boat to handle cleanly, and took damage that made taking off again impossible. The hull was intact, but the aircraft was not going anywhere under its own wings. Now here's where it gets interesting. Towers did not radio for rescue. He ordered the crew to rig a jury sail from fabric they had aboard. He got the outboard engines that still functioned running at low power, and he started taxiing on the surface of the North Atlantic Ocean in a damaged flying boat. He navigated roughly 200 miles over 2 full days until the island of Fayal appeared on the horizon. NC-3 motored into Ponta Delgada Harbor under its own power, salt-crusted and battered and barely recognizable as the same aircraft that had departed Trepassi Bay. The aircraft was too damaged to continue, but Towers and his crew arrived on their own terms. That story of taxiing a flying boat across open ocean for 2 days almost never gets told, and it deserves a great deal more attention than history has given it. NC-4 came through. Reed had found clearer air south of the worst weather and navigated by stars when they were visible and by the destroyer chain when they weren't. After 15 hours and 18 minutes of sustained flight, a new record for overwater aviation, NC-4 settled onto the harbor at Horta in the Azores. The crew stepped out onto the hull, looked at each other, and mostly just went to work checking the aircraft. They spent 5 days in the Azores waiting for the next weather window. 5 days is a long time to sit still after crossing 1,200 miles of ocean for the first time in history. On May 20th, the very calendar date that, 8 years later, Charles Lindbergh would depart Roosevelt Field on his famous solo flight to Paris, NC-4 lifted off from the Azores and flew 9 hours and 26 minutes to Lisbon, Portugal. The crowds along the Tagus River that afternoon were enormous. Portugal had sent a destroyer as an escort. The welcome in Lisbon was extraordinary by any measure. 7 days later, on May 27th, 1919, NC-4 completed the final leg north to Plymouth, England. 27 days after departing New York, the first aircraft to cross the Atlantic Ocean, Albert Cushing Reed, asked by a British journalist what the crossing had been like, is reported to have said approximately this, rather foggy, in places. The destroyers were extremely helpful. That is, as far as I'm concerned, the perfect answer from the perfect officer. The water was rough and the ships were helpful. What else do you need? The crew returned home to a ticker tape parade in New York that drew hundreds of thousands of people. Congress authorized special medals. President Wilson sent congratulations. The Navy was justifiably proud, and then history began to move on. When John Alcock and Arthur Witten Brown made their non-stop crossing 3 weeks after NC-4 arrived in Plymouth, flying a converted Vickers Vimy bomber through icing and cloud and a terrifying near spiral that nearly drove them into the Atlantic before they recovered at low altitude, the non-stop achievement captured something the stage crossing hadn't quite matched. Alcock and Brown claimed the Daily Mail Prize and got the major headlines, and when Lindbergh departed Roosevelt Field on May 20, 1927, and landed at Le Bourget 33 and a half hours later, the image of one young man alone in a silver monoplane over the dark ocean became the defining picture of transatlantic flight. 200,000 people met him at Le Bourget. The world never forgot his name. NC-4, the aircraft that had actually done it first, was donated to the Smithsonian Institution in 1924. It sat in storage and on display in various configurations for decades. Eventually, it was transferred to the place where I think it was always meant to end up, the National Naval Aviation Museum in Pensacola, Florida. If you have never been to Pensacola, understand what is waiting for you there. The National Naval Aviation Museum is free to the public, free, somehow, given the depth of the collection. 700 aircraft, naval aviation from the earliest days of flight through the jet age and into the space program. It sits right on the flight line at Naval Air Station Pensacola, where generations of Navy and Marine pilots first learned what the sky feels like. Half the docents are retired naval aviators who flew jets and helicopters off carriers and will stand there and talk to you for as long as you're willing to stay. NC-4 hangs in the main atrium. Not a replica, the aircraft. More than 100 years of existence have left their mark. The museum has made deliberate choices in favor of preservation over cosmetic restoration, which I think is exactly right. The marks of its history are in the structure. You can see what time does to an aircraft that crossed the North Atlantic in an era when that wasn't supposed to be possible. When you stand under that hull and look up at those wings stretching out above you, the scope of what these six men did starts to land on you slowly, the way real things do. 15 hours over open ocean at night, two sister ships down on the surface. Dead reckoning and star shots, and the faint flicker of a destroyer's searchlight through the fog below, the constant thunder of four Liberty engines. The cold of a May night over the Atlantic. The smell of oil and gasoline and salt water mixing in the open hull. They did it, and most of the world never quite got around to remembering. The museum gives NC-4 the context it deserves. The crew biographies, the navigation charts, the photographs from Plymouth Harbor, the story of towers taxiing across the ocean surface. All of it is there if you take the time to look. Go see it. Bring your logbook if you want to feel appropriately humbled. My sources today come from the Naval History and Heritage Command and the National Naval Aviation Museum's published history of the 1919 transatlantic crossing. You'll find us at radiohangar.com. For the hangar, I'm Tail Dragger. Take care of yourselves out there.